The Twilight movie is going to make a ton of money, even though it doesn't feature Hollywood's trend of the year, 3D. Studios are demanding that more and more live-action movies be shot in 3D. As NPR's Neda Ulubi reports, that means even the most experienced filmmakers are having to learn a whole new set of technical skills.
We're ready, Dave. Okay,
here we go. Ready?
On a dimly lit soundstage at the Sony studio backlot, about 30 cinematographers and camera operators are practicing a kind of filmmaking most of them have never done before.
I was trying to, keep it on his chest there, but then have his head kind of pop off the screen.
This free 3-day boot camp is the brainchild of Buzz Hayes, who runs Sony's 3D Technology Center. He says 3D is not a trend.
It's been relegated to the gimmick bin for far too long. But for those of us who have been working in 3D for a while, we realize that there's a certain truth to a 3D image, that if it's treated well, you can actually really engage an audience in a way that you could never do in two dimensions.
He says in the movie Beowulf, for example, characters become more three-dimensional as they rise in power. And there was that awesome dragon exploding out of a cave. But the boot camp begins with serious lectures.
So we have to use convergence to take the depth that we've decided upon with our interaxial control and slide it back into the display surface.
Convergence, so interaxial, like interocular. The cinematographers and camera people are gearheads game to master this technology, but they do have some reservations.
It's cumbersome. I'm sure we'll get used to it.
Camera assistant Jamie Fells is tiny, and she's not convinced the payoff of switching to a hulking 3D camera that looks like a small tank is worth it.
I personally don't care about seeing a 3D movie. I'm not a 14-year-old boy.
But Fells is about to make a movie that may appeal to one. Harold and Kumar in 3D. Before the shoot in Michigan, the film's entire camera crew is here at 3D boot camp.
The rig that we'll be using in Detroit is 140 pounds. Four people have to carry it.
This is a huge concern for cinematographers because we fought so long to get our cameras to a point where you could hide them in places, you could carry them, you could place them in objects where the cameras never went before.
That's Rodney Charters, the longtime cinematographer for TV's 24, a show he says would never have worked in 3D because the camera had to be nimble enough to follow the star.
We were with Kiefer the whole time because of the physicality of the camera, and that's all gone now.
Gone, thanks largely to one movie, Avatar. Before Avatar, the most cutting-edge 3D films were animated. Now everyone from Martin Scorsese to Werner Herzog is making live-action 3D. Avatar completely changed the ambitions of directors, studios, and eager young film students. Perry Hoberman teaches at USC's School of Cinematic Arts, where demand for 3D training has skyrocketed.
A year ago, it was mostly animation students, but now, especially since Avatar, the production students, who are much more interested in live action, are really gunning to go.
So have you added faculty to help meet the demand?
We haven't added faculty yet. We hope to.
It's hard, says Perry, to hire people to teach 3D when so few can actually do it.
I mean, there are a few people who are very, very experienced, but by and large, the industry doesn't have the kind of accumulative knowledge of making film after film after film after film.
And that is what Sony wants to change with its 3D boot camps. Buzz Hayes, the director of Sony's 3D Tech Center, says they're free for a reason.
The payback for us is eventually someone will either do a Sony picture or they'll work with Sony equipment or they'll buy a Sony Bravia. That's really the payback for us.
And as 3D televisions begin to hit the market, it's in Sony's best interest to ensure directors and cinematographers can produce content to fill them.
Focus is starting near, and as soon as Bagman gets up, it pushes far.
Right now, they're practicing with a scene where an actor steals a homeless guy's bag. Over and over, the same wordless scene gets shot and reshot. One time, everyone goes wild with approval. I assumed some fancy 3D tech trick had been pulled off with great skill, but no. Cinematographer Rodney Charter said what killed was the performance.
He kicked him in the guts and ran off. And the actors, it's always about the actors, and we're just there to film what they do.
No matter how many dimensions, if it's not entertaining, no one will watch it. Neda Ulubi, NPR News.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're going to switch gears now and talk about matters of personal finance. Last week, House and Senate lawmakers agreed on a financial reform package that's being touted as the most significant financial reform effort since the Great Depression. Now, passage of the bill is not certain. A vote by the full House could come soon, but the death of Democratic Senator Robert Byrd could slow things down in the Senate. But if the bill is passed, it would change a good many rules that directly affect consumers. So we wanted to know more about how these changes would affect or could affect all of us. So we've called our Tell Me More regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy, Alvin Hall, as well as Jacob Goldstein, who's a blogger and correspondent with NPR's Planet Money team. And welcome to you both. Welcome back, I should say.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Now, Alvin, I'm going to ask you, what's the most important thing about this bill if it should pass?
The most important thing to me relates to mortgages. It would stop all of the selling of mortgages that pay high fees to the people who promote them, and it would stop this prepayment penalty. I think that for the average person who wants to get on the property ladder in the States, this is important. And with the establishment of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, at least they have the framework of some organization that will start to look at these financial products and financial practices from the consumer's point of view.
Now, Jacob, an Office of Credit Ratings has been created. Now, that's meant to supervise rating agencies. What would that do, and why is that important to consumers?
Well, it's important because the credit agencies, they really fell short during the boom. You know, there are a few big credit rating agencies, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, and they gave very, very high ratings to these bonds that were full of mortgages, basically saying these are super safe investments. Well, as it turned out, they weren't that safe, and lots of people lost a lot of money on it, and that was a really key piece of the financial crisis. In fact, though, the bill ultimately was not as tough as it might have been on the credit rating agencies. It is true that now investors who feel they were burned by a bad rating from the rating agencies can sue the credit rating agencies, but it's really unclear how powerful this new office is going to be. The bill called for a study of rating agencies, and you know, really in Washington, when somebody calls for a study, they're saying, let's just put this off. We don't really want to deal with it right now.
Yeah, kick the can down the road.
There really is some of that with the rating agencies in the bill.
Alvin, what about you? If you'd pick up where Jacob just left off, where does this bill fall short in your view from the consumer standpoint?
Mm-hmm. A lot of the provisions are being phased in over a period of time. And I worry that the lobbyists will get to the lawmakers and gradually water down these bills. Also, I really worry about who's going to work at this new bureau. Jacob and I were talking, and I said, typically you find that the people they put in place are politicians or people with political agendas. So they'll hire people that they know. Will they put people in these organizations who really understand the needs of the average person? One of the things that Jacob was mentioned to me before we went on air was about people at small bodegas who already set credit card limits on the amount that they would set. The fact that they would put this into law and the lawmakers did not seem to know that there were already firms doing this seems clueless.
Well, I think what you're talking about is the bill allows business owners to set minimums on credit card transactions up to $10. You're saying that they couldn't do that. And you were just saying small business people do that.
All the time.
I was actually confused when I read that this was in the bill. So just to be clear, the new rule says, hey, you know, a merchant, a store owner, if you accept credit cards, you're allowed to say, we only accept credit cards if you're buying $10
or
more.
Yeah.
And I actually thought like I was reading it wrong because like every corner store you ever go into, they won't let you use a credit card for, you know, a bottle of water or whatever. You got to spend $10. But it turns out that's been illegal, but it's sort of irrelevant, right? It's a law that nobody followed.
Interesting. Well, there's another thing I was curious about is that auto lenders are apparently not covered under this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Jacob, do I have that right? Why is that? I
mean, well, that was actually one of the big debates, and that was going back and forth until the last minute in this bill. And one interesting detail about that was actually the military was really pushing hard for auto dealers to be included in this, and it's because auto dealers are actually a big source of credit to a lot of working people. You know, you go buy a car and they say, we'll give this to you with no money down, we'll make you a great loan package. So essentially, they they are acting like a financial institution, right? Because they're basically giving you a loan to buy that car. And there was a lot of debate about, you know, are they or are they not financial institutions? And they ultimately won a carve out from the bill and are not covered by some of the provisions.
And are not covered. So, Alva, I'm going to ask you for an opinion about whether this is a net positive or a net negative for consumers. Do you think at the end of the day, despite the fact that you take issue with some of the things that are not in the bill and things that you feel might be watered down, do you think it's a net positive from your perspective?
I do think it's a net positive. I think the people who get bad credit interest rates on their credit card or are turned down for mortgages or turned down on an apartment because of their credit score, they can at least get their credit score. The provisions that say that these institutions now have to act at least some of the time in your behalf, in your best interest, that's good. I think anytime you have an organization focusing on the needs of the consumers rather than the needs of business at the fault of the consumer, I think it's good.
And then, Jake, I'm going to ask you, what is the likely ongoing pushback to this? Because obviously the argument has been all along that whenever you add an additional layer of bureaucracy, it drives up the cost for consumers, it makes things less convenient for consumers, et cetera. That is the perspective. So what are there likely areas that the people who oppose this bill are likely to pursue in the days ahead, even as I said, the passage of the bill is not certain?
Well, you know, one argument that a lot of people make is fewer people are going to be able to get loans, right? If you make it harder to give loans, if you add new rules about giving loans, if you add costs to the banks, they'll say we won't be able to give as many people loans. And when we do give loans, the interest rates will be higher. You know, on the other hand, to just turn it back around again, I think there's a reasonable argument that during the boom, a lot of people got loans they shouldn't have been getting in the first place. Alvin had mentioned mortgages as one of the things that will change the most for consumers as a result of this bill, and I certainly agree with that. And you know, one of the provisions of the bill says the banks has to try and make sure that somebody can pay a mortgage back before they give them a loan, which is ridiculous on its face, right? Like, you need a law for this? But it's really a sign, I think, of how loose credit had gotten and you know, the fact that, yes, it will be a little bit harder to get a loan now, and that may be appropriate.
Mm. Okay, of which more later. We'll come back to you guys when the bill finally passes and we can talk more. Jacob Goldstein is a blogger and correspondent with NPR's Planet Money team. Alvin Hall is our regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy. They both joined us from our bureau in New York. Gentlemen, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
Imagine being in your 30s or 40s and writing a letter to your 20-year-old self. What would you say? That's what Cassie Bourne requested on her blog. She's a 22-year-old college student and single mom, and she needed advice, so she asked some of her older fellow bloggers to write letters to themselves when they were in their 20s. And here are some of the responses that she got. Sarah Brown wrote, "First of all, let's get this out of the way. No, you are not crazy. Yes, you should probably talk to someone. There's no shame in that. You should also get outside more." And this from Jessica Gottlieb. "You're going to meet a really nice guy who's going to take you helicopter skiing and send you mountains of flowers. He is bad news. Trust your instincts." Cassie Bourne is the woman who started this letter project, and she joins us now from Davenport, Iowa. Welcome, Cassie.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, where did you get this idea that you wanted to turn to some of your fellow bloggers who are a little bit longer in years and ask for their advice?
Well, I actually started blogging a couple of years ago, and I had traveled around to a lot of conferences and met a lot of really great women. And in our conversations, I always picked their brains about what I should be doing, and I wanted to find a way to take all of the great stories that I had collected and be able to share them with other women my age and to give them the access to that advice.
You know, some of them are unvarnished.
Yes.
I'm looking at a letter from Jen. "First of all, that guy you're dating, you're not going to marry him, in spite of the fact that you'll get engaged to him in about a year. I know it's nice to have something to fall back on while you're away at college, but once you get back to Houston, you won't be able to date any stoner snowboarding guy, so you might as well get it out of your system now.
Yes, a lot of them are very honest, and what I found about those specific stories is you know that when she was in that moment and when she was trying to decide what to do, it was such a big deal and such a big decision, and to be able to look back on that and say, hey, you made a mistake. It's not a big deal. Everything turns out okay. And that message is so encouraging to hear. Like, you know, these big things that are in your face that you're so scared of, in 10 years, you're going to be laughing about that same thing.
You know, this is a great idea for collecting advice. It's almost like collecting recipes. So if you had sort of a Rolodex of great advice that you got through all these letters, do me a favor and sort of tick through it. Just pull out various cards and tell me what you've learned.
I have learned to appreciate myself more, both my body and the kind of person that I am, and those things in your personality that might be a little quirky or a little odd or might make you seem a little dorky are actually, you know, they're there for a reason, and in 10 years you may figure out what that reason is. I've learned to take myself less seriously, not worry about where I'm going and what I'm going to accomplish and focusing in on the fact that I'm 20 years old and you have to enjoy this time because it's only here for so long. I've learned a lot about how quickly things change and just realizing that wherever you are in your life right now, you're not going to be there forever. And I think that was the biggest lesson. It's so easy to get caught up in what's happening today and what's happening this week. But in 5 years, you're probably not going to remember today or this week. So just do the best that you can and enjoy the moments that you have.
Why do you think so many people actually wrote these letters to their younger selves?
I think that especially in women, there's this desire to support each other. And a lot of people wrote me and said, this was so therapeutic to look back at what I was doing in my 20s that I realized maybe I hadn't forgiven myself for. And in writing this letter, it was almost like a closure of I know you made mistakes. I know your 20s were hard, but things are good now. And I'm going to let this part of my life go and just close that era.
Cassie Bourne works in social media, and she blogs at her own site. It's called CassieBourne.com. That's B-O-O-R-N. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we also want to invite you to share your letters to your 20-something selves. You can do that at our website. That's NPR.org. Get busy.
More All Things Considered right after this.
And our last word is not my cup of tea. In Salem, Oregon, the Tea Party Bookshop has been extra busy in recent months. Followers of the Tea Party political movement discovered the bookshop, perhaps by Googling the name. They've been calling, even visiting, in search of literature associated with their cause, and they've often been disappointed. Instead of books about Sarah Palin, they find tomes on Buddhism, spirituality, and green living. Tea Party Bookshop owner Joanne Kohler has decided now to redefine her business, so much so that she's changing the name of her store. As of the 1st of July, it will be called Tigress Books, a name inspired by the blessing of a Tibetan Buddhist monk. And that's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly.